We're gonna open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. You have something to say, Representative?
We were wondering if they were coming, we could take their seats so we could see the screen.
Oh, we haven't heard that they're going to be missing, right?
Shall we wait 5 minutes? Start, and then if they don't come, maybe we can trade seats.
Sure, okay. All right, we're going to open up the informational hearing on the Early Learning System Hub Report with Jada Rupley and others. Thank you for coming today. We're excited to hear what's going on.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. My name is Jada Rupley, members of the committee. I have with me Megan Irwin, who is staff. And then we have from the Yamhill Hub, we have Michelle. And I want to start by telling you that Michelle, 2 hours ago, is a stand-in for the flu. So even we are experiencing health issues. And this is the first time she's ever been in front of a committee. I told her this was a good one to start with.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much for inviting us to come back and give you an update. And I'd like to turn to the first slide. Why we are here is we submitted a report required by us by House Bill 2013 for the demonstration projects of the early learning hubs. And as you see, what we are required to do is, I keep looking at you and you say Representative Gilliam, you guys are going to confuse.
No, we better change it. Send it down
there. There you go. So. And we are going to let you know a little bit on the progress in terms of the updates for the early learning hubs, the effectiveness to date, what we have in the transition of services in communities. And we thought one of the best ways to do that was to bring with you, with us, someone from the community to be able to explain what's going on in their community. So with that, I'm going to let Megan kind of go over some of the specifics that we're looking at for the hubs, and your next page will be the map, so we can look at that.
Thank you, Jada. Here today, members of the committee, my name is Megan Irwin, and for the record, I'm the Early Learning System Design Manager for the Early Learning Division. And today, I'm going to spend some time walking you through the implementation of the Early Learning Hub project to date, and also talk a little bit about what we can expect for the future in the next couple of months. Once I'm done, you'll have the opportunity to hear from Michelle Bergeron, whose last name I always say wrong, so probably got that wrong. She's the Early Learning Coordinator for the Yamhill CCO, which is also the Yamhill Early Learning Hub. And we invited Michelle today because Yamhill is one of our hubs with some of the very strongest linkages across health, human services, early education, and into K-12. They're just starting out, but they have some really fabulous ideas, and we wanted you to hear it directly from the person on the ground who is truly doing the work instead of the state agency. So as a brief reminder around what early learning hubs are tasked with doing, they have 5 core responsibilities. Finding the children who are most at risk of arriving at kindergarten unprepared for school, working with their families to identify each child's specific needs, connecting those children to services that will meet their needs, working across traditional silos, something Yamhill is doing fabulously, and accounting for outcomes collectively. The silos that they're tasked with working across by statute are health, human services, early education, K-12, and the private sector. And the outcomes that they're responsible for accounting for collectively are kindergarten readiness, family stability, and system coordination. And I know this has been repeated many times over the past few years, but it's always helpful to start with a little bit of a reminder. So I am excited to share that even since the Early Learning Hub report that we're here to talk about today was published on February 3rd, we've made some additional progress. On February 13th, the Early Learning Council approved moving forward with 5 additional hubs to award contracts to. 2 of them have some additional work to do in terms of setting more ambitious improvement targets before we'll sign the contract, but we're excited that we now have 6 hubs that have moved forward to contract. And across these 6, we'll have hub coverage for about 40% of our state's at-risk population using OHA and DHS service load as a proxy for understanding the at-risk population in our state. So what you're looking at here is what the map currently looks like. Our hubs so far are Early Learning Hub, Inc., which covers Marion County, Frontier Oregon Early Learning Hub, which covers Grant and Harney counties, South Central Oregon Early Learning Hub, which covers Douglas and Lake, Yamhill Early Learning Hub, which covers Yamhill, the Lane Early Learning Alliance, Lane County, and Early Learning Multnomah, which is Multnomah County. And they're sponsored by a variety of different kinds of organizations. In two communities, the United Way has stepped up as the backbone organization. In Yamhill, it's the CCO. In other communities, it's county government in partnership with the Education Service District. So we have an interesting array of organizations that have stepped up to be the lead conveners for this work. And as you know, per legislation, we have 10 more contracts that we can award this biennium. And to date, we have gotten now 10 letters of interest for round two. Now, I need to say that that doesn't mean we'll only have 10 additional applicants. The letters of interest are non-binding, and I actually do expect that we'll have at least one or two applicants step forward to apply when the application goes live in the next round. But to date, we've had 10 communities express interest in round two.
Can I ask a question right there?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that 10 cover all the rest of the state that's not currently covered, or are they masked in a few
areas? There's four counties that are still kind of trying to figure it out how they want to organize themselves. Representative Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, there's four counties that we haven't noticed us of their intent to apply.
I was wondering, do you know why Jackson and Josephine counties have not applied?
Yes. Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett. In the first round, Jackson and Josephine counties chose not to step forward to apply. They didn't feel ready. They have noticed us of their intent to apply together in round two.
Okay.
So, and we'll talk a lot more about round two toward the end of my part of this presentation. For now, I want to focus us on where we're at in implementation to date. And the first piece of implementation I want to take just a few minutes to unpack with you is funding. So in the last legislative session, for this biennium only, $700,000 were appropriated to counties for service continuity. So that means every county received funds to continue to supply early learning services through the transition from the Commission on Children and Families system to the HUB system. And for the first year of the biennium only, we also continued to fund services through the counties. And those funding streams that went out to counties for this first year of the biennium are what you're looking at on your screen right now. Family support services, Great Start, children, youth, and families, and family support dollars. So all of the funds that counties previously got and under the Commission on Children and Families, they still received this year to avoid service interruption while we're doing this implementation process. In the last legislative session, $3.9 million was set aside for a Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund. $4.3 million was set aside for the Early Learning Division to contract with relief nurseries directly. And then $4.3 million was appropriated for the infrastructure and the launch of early learning hubs. And that is the funding that we're bidding out through this RFA process that we're doing right now. A few things will change structurally on July 1st of this year in terms of funding. There are service dollars that formerly went out through the Commission on Children and Families that will begin to go out through hubs on that date. And that's what you're looking at here on the screen. Those funding streams are Family Support, Great Start, and Healthy Families Oregon. Out of those funds, Healthy Families dollars have to be spent on the Healthy Families Oregon model that they were appropriated for, and the other two funding streams are available for hubs to contract out for services in their community that fit within their overall strategy for kindergarten readiness and family stability. And in addition to that, the Early Learning Council has decided to make funds that are available through an early literacy strategic investment run through hubs where they exist to ensure that as new funding streams are coming online, we're administering them through the hubs to the extent possible.
Good
question. These are the only
funds. So if you'll go back to the previous slide, three of the five then are funded. Are the others dropping off from the funding, not being funded?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, that's an excellent question. The Healthy Families Oregon, Great Start, Children, Youth, and Families, Family Support Services are all moving forward as part of the hub system. Relief nurseries will continue to receive funding, but directly from the division. And the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund is a new fund that's going out through a competitive RFA that is former Commission on Children and Families dollars that was set aside for this particular fund.
Follow up. So are we going to see any change in up or down to our counties in the amount of money that they will receive in the future from what they've received now to set these up?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, my understanding is that it follows the same allocation in terms of the service dollars that has been used in the past, but we can do a little bit of research with our fiscal policy analyst to answer that question specifically.
Okay, follow up. I'm asking because a lot of these counties are in really bad financial straits right now, and they've hired people to gear up, and they're getting ready for all this, and we need to know, are you going to take, or it, not you, is all of the money going to be available in the future to pay all the people that we're hiring to gear up for this? That's what we're after. I'm after.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, I think that, actually I want to probably address the part that you're saying with counties. For example, let's use Yamhill for the example, is the new service entity is the CCO. So the money will no longer go to Yamhill County. It will go to the CCO and the hubs to determine that. So if indeed the applicant for the hub was a county, then those monies would continue to go to the hub to decide how to work. But if indeed the county was not the applicant, then it would go to the hubs that we selected. So the formulas are still the same. They're based on kids and formulas, but it may not be directly to a county. So does that help a little?
It does. Just trying to help to inform our counties what they can expect if they have county employees doing some of the jobs that are now going to be hired or done through the hubs. Are they going to lay people off, have to lay them off in the county? And, you know, I think it's important for you to let the counties know what, how to expect the distribution of funds coming to them, the county commissioners, if you would.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, we'll make sure and do another communication out, but I think that we believe the county should understand that the money starting July 1 will go to those designated hubs. And many, we expect that many of them might be that, but that they will look a little bit different for those that are not, for example, in some of them. Thank you.
You're welcome. And as I remember, we started this process at least 2 years ago, right? And so the counties have been brought along all along, knowing that there was going to be a different allocation and that we were setting up the hubs. So there will be more communication about what they've been able to achieve with the money that's going to the counties and the hubs. Is that right?
Chair Tomei, that is correct.
Yeah. If I may. Some of our counties have a 100% turnover in the individuals who knew what was going on 2 years ago versus now. Our county has new commissioners, and so the institutional memory is gone
right
from some of the counties, and so that's what I'm trying to get at. If you can work with the counties to help the new people who don't know what the old people knew that are now gone, that would be great.
Departments of Human Services, I would think, would have had this information for several years and know that this is happening. I would hope that they would be communicating this to their commissioners.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, that's just a good thing for us to pay attention to, and we'll do that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, the final piece I want to just highlight on funding is that these are the only funding streams that are available to hubs directly in terms of service delivery that they're responsible for. However, they have a broader responsibility to coordinate services across sectors, and so there are some funds that the Early Learning Division contract out directly, including Relief Nurseries and the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, where we've included contract language for those programs to know that they need to coordinate and work with their hub toward a shared set of strategies and a shared set of outcomes. But we just want to make sure to be clear that early learning hubs are not the directly responsible for Oregon pre-kindergarten or relief nursery funds.
Sure.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. So the Healthy Families Oregon used to go through the Commission on Children and Families, and now it's going through the hub. Is there anything different about it? They get the same allocation per how many kids, firstborn, whatever the risk criteria is. It's the exact same thing. It's just going through.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. If you look in House Bill 2013, one of the things that is different with Healthy Families is that they did expand beyond firstborn in mm-hmm. terms of families determined mm-hmm. at risk. So that is the one difference programmatically. This year, we have funded those programs directly, and in some counties, they actually had additional money from some of their Children, Youth, and Family and Great Start funds, and so we did also forward those dollars from those counties that had identified those for additional funding. So we are directly funding them, and they will go through the hubs.
So, thank you. So right now it's still done kind of by a formula. And ultimately my understanding was that what we want to do is be able to blend these funds. And so a hub could say, well, we want to put more resources into healthy families and less into here, or more into here and less into healthy families, depending on what we think the needs are. Is that still the vision ultimately? And right now you're still working on a formula because you're in a transition period?
So I'm not going to say Chair Tome, I'm going to say Vice Chair Olson. Representative Kenny Geyer, that is correct.
Okay.
These will be community, I'm not going to say county, those will be hub-based, and they will determine those priorities. And remember also what has come out is the kindergarten assessment, and so we are in the process of getting those hubs the kindergarten readiness data for their area too, so they may choose to target those areas.
One last question. So part of that was being able to get a waiver from the federal government, since the funds for healthy families, for instance, starts at the federal level, to be able to combine that in a pot and with other funds use it. Is that correct? And if so, have those waivers been requested?
So Chair Tome, Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't think that we anticipate any change this year in the way that we serve healthy families. We will continue to do that in a home visitation model and look at that to the future. So you would not see that happen in this first year.
Okay.
Until they know what they're doing.
Thank you, Jada. So Chair Tome, members of the committee, the next piece that I wanted to just kind of help you understand is the implementation timeline that we're working on. As you can probably imagine, implementing a project of this scale requires a pretty thoughtful and phased approach just to figuring out where are the hubs going to be located and what are the strategies that they're going to put forward. And so we've carved it out into five phases, and on this slide you see each phase spelled out. The first two phases were really focused on the launch of the first round of applications, evaluating them, and getting through contract with the first batch. And those are now complete as of the Early Learning Council's meeting on the 13th, where they decided where to award the final contracts. We are into phase three, which is all about providing support for applicant communities that are not hubs yet. And we'll move into phase four upon the evaluation of this next batch of applications and making final decisions about who we will award early learning hub contracts to. And then the final piece on this slide is all about moving from deciding where these are going to be to implementation and providing all of the support that we can provide for communities to successfully execute their strategies, including figuring out how to remove some of the barriers that Representative Kenny Geyer was just so smartly pointing out. So let's talk a little bit about what we did in the first round of the RFA. Phase one began in July when the legislative session ended, and we put out the first request for application. It was open for 45 days. While it was open, we visited communities across the state doing as much question and answer as a competitive procurement process allows us to do. In the first round of applications, we had 15 applicants, and statutorily we were allowed to award up to 7 contracts in that first round. We evaluated the applications, and as you're aware, the Early Learning Council chose to initially award 1 contract without any further questions to that applicant and 5 more pending the receipt of additional information. Those 5 applicants did a wonderful job answering the council's questions. We've now moved them forward to contract. The Early Learning Council in this first round had a hard task of choosing who would get to go first out of these 15 applicants that we had. And so I wanted to speak very briefly to why those first six were selected. They had cohesive connections between their strategies and the tasks that they were saying they were going to do and the outcomes that they want to achieve for children in their community. These applicants also had a high level of clarity about who their target population of children are and how to find their target population. I think one really lovely example of that is from Marion County, where they've decided to focus on Oregon Health Plan children, and then have even further refined where they want to concentrate based on school catchment zones where poverty is high and third grade reading performance is low. And they're now layering into that the results of the kindergarten assessment. These applicants also had strong and really intentional connections to the early learning provider community. And finally, they had strong and clearly fleshed out governance models and bylaws, so you could feel that you could trust them with the investment that you're making. Moving forward, we have a second round of applications that we still need to get through to decide where to award these final contracts. April 1st is when we'll launch that next round. Building up to that, we are providing support to communities that are not yet hubs through a series of policy webinars that are being done by early learning division staff and subject matter experts that are universal and available to everybody. And then we've also brought on support for strategic planning and helping folks understand how to do the kind of cross-sector collaboration that we're asking for. And that's being provided to any prospective applicant that asks for it, and it's tailored and community-specific. Once we get through the contracting process with this second cohort that's coming on, our work will be really focused on the deep supports needed to help hubs be successful in implementing their plans, to support family stability, kindergarten readiness, and system coordination. We expect that work to really kick off in a learning collaborative model, very similar to what you've seen with the coordinated care organizations. We're starting that with cohort one, but it'll really go statewide in August once we're through the contracting process. And with that, I'm going to hand it back to Jada just to talk a little bit more about where we think we're going in the future, and then we'll hear from Michelle.
Chair Tomei, committee members, I just wanted to finish up as we look to the future. There are two additional funding sources that the Early Learning Council have put out. They're out in competitive nature right now, and that is the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund. If you remember, that will be designed for basically 3 years old through third grade, so it's partnerships with schools and community providers to work together. We're looking for some of the best and brightest folks to talk to us about what innovations that would help Oregon look at moving the dial for the third grade reading assessments. And then the second part is early literacy grants, which were part of House Bill 3232, the strategic initiatives that went out for the OEIB. And those are going to both public and private providers looking at evidence-based literacy for based under age six. And so those are going to be, they're out with communities right now, and I think Michelle will say that she's busy writing both of those in Yamhill, and the idea they will come back in and we will award those out too. With that, I would like to let you, if there are any questions of either Megan or I, otherwise we can move to hear a little bit about what's going on in Yamhill.
Thank you for coming today. I see no questions. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I apologize. I have never done this before. My name is Michelle Bergeron, and I am the Yamhill Early Learning Hub Coordinator. And thank you so much for letting us come and talk about what we're doing out there. We're really excited about how we're going to be able to take what started as a conversation in a coffee shop with some providers, you know, and how can we, looking at how can we make better outcomes for our kids. And over the last 2 years, a group of early learning providers and other agencies in the county have met twice a month looking at what are our goals and how can we implement strategies that will help us attain those goals. We are really pleased that we were able to go under the structure of the Yamhill Coordinated Care Organization, seeing that there's just some really strong alignments between the goals that the CCO has and the goals that we have as a community to really improve health and life for our youngest kids. And that collaboration between the two entities, I think, is going to really help us to achieve things more quickly with better buy-in from all sectors in our community. You have, I believe, in your handout an attachment that Sue Linsmeyer put together for you, just kind of giving you an idea of where we're headed with our strategies to start implementing some of these wonderful or to start achieving, some of these wonderful outcomes that we have for our kids. we're in the process really of building the infrastructure. We have an early learning council, which is an advisory committee to our Yamhill CCO board, and our first subcommittee underneath that advisory group is a design committee, which will be really on the ground working out some of the hard questions, answering some of those hard questions, and putting in place some of the strategies. We also find that it's, or feel that it's really important that we begin to build some advisory to that board from the community level, and are looking at putting together some parent advisory councils and some family resource management councils, which come out of our early childhood coordinating council. The early childhood coordinating council was a body that was a part of our Commission on Children and Families, and that group has been meeting, goodness, I think I've heard something like 15 years, and it really has always been very impressive to me, being a part of that group as a, in a, with the literacy initiative that the commission had, and watching that group function, and just seeing how people communicate, have been communicating so well and working together and getting outside of their silos. That's why I think we were so well positioned to apply for this opportunity, because we already had started those hard conversations and really had a willingness to work together. Let's see. Where are we at here? Looking at the family resource manager functions, I know that that's been, or what I've heard is that that's been a sticking point for a lot of communities. How do we effectively make that happen? And when we looked at the big picture, what we saw is that it really needs to be a similar kind of coming together of a lot of different entities that can affect all levels of our community. And so looking at it in terms of functions, the data management and that higher level of just organizational function will be coming from our Early Learning Council coordinator, so our Early Learning Hub coordinator, which will be myself. And then we're working with our Yamhill CCO to, as a part of their transformation funds, they're going to be putting together a medical home model, and they will be hiring someone who will manage a lot of those prenatal conversations, communications, to try to get young pregnant mothers into some good care and make sure that they have all the supports that they need. And we saw that as a really good opportunity to pull in that level of commitment from the CCO into our family core. Our family core is a model where we have local providers who are meeting once a week to look at the needs of the families that are represented through those different agencies, and really trying to evaluate, are we meeting their needs as best we can? Is there another agency that could potentially do that better? We've instituted a referral form for this family core, which is going out to all providers, not just early learning, but medical providers in the community as well, as an opportunity for them to look at be able to see visually what are the supports available to families and where can we plug them in and hopefully get their needs met. By having this maternal medical coordinator person be able to impact both sides, we feel like that's going to be a really nice fit, and it's going to get the families the need help that they need early on. But we're also wanting to pull in some of our local volunteer groups, which through the Parent Advisory Council and through the Family Resource Management teams on the ground, they can help us see at a community level what the gaps are in the needs that those community members have. It's all still coming together, and we're sure that we'll probably hit some snags along the way, but we're really excited about the opportunities that we have to impact change, and I feel like we've got a great start. So I think that that's about all that I had to present. If you have questions.
I think we're very excited to hear this, and it's just a wonderful program, it sounds like, you're starting. And speaking of healthy starts, I think all of us realize in this committee, at least, that the earlier we can get to these young families, the better. So I'm glad you're dealing, especially focusing on pregnant women so that they can get the services they need as soon as their babies, and before their babies are being born. So
Thank you. That's great. Thank you.
Representative Folsom.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Michelle, I guess this is for you because you've already gotten fairly well involved in what's happening in your county.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you have a family that chooses not to want to go through the risk assessment of their child, you know, from birth to age 3? From what I'm reading back at the statute and everything when we passed it last year, the volunteer part of it and everything, but how do you, I'm just kind of wondering, how do you reach out to them and work with them, or do you?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson. I think that is one of the hardest questions. And, you know, I'm not an early learning provider, but in listening to my community speak to that exact question, I think what we're trying to do is find ways to speak to them through the people that they have the best connection with. We've really been able to strengthen our relationship with our pediatricians. All of them have come on board to use the Ages and Stages questionnaire for developmental screenings, which we feel really pleased with, the fact that they're recognizing that a uniformity is important. And they're also really beginning to listen to and work with the Early Learning Hub as it starts up. And I know that that's one of the ways that we're looking at really trying to reach those families who maybe would otherwise, you know, say, no, we don't want to be involved, is if their physicians can help deliver that message. Beyond that, I don't have a lot of the specific strategy of, I mean, I know that it's just going to be a matter of outreach. We have a Fostering Hope initiative in McMinnville, and that's looking to expand. And through that, we're using community connectors in neighborhoods so that they're going out and specifically talking with families and bringing families together to help assess those needs. And I think that that will be another opportunity for us, is through parents talking to parents. So I hope that answers your question.
Just follow up that. And Jolly, you might want to throw in on this one too, or Megan. What's happening with the connection then for the school districts and their involvement? Because I'm just kind of seeing that maybe as clearly a door.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, we have a really strong connection going with our K-12 system. They have been at the table through this entire process of working through our strategies, and they are a big part of how we are going to help find those kids. They've got homeless liaisons that are working in their schools, and they're really focusing in on some of our poverty hotspots and those catchment areas around those schools. And so those communications are ongoing. We also have each representative from each of our school districts on our Early Learning Council so that they can be attuned to what we're hoping to accomplish and help us accomplish that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Just following up on Representative Olson's question, a number of us are on the Higher Ed Committee as well, and so, you know, when we think about the 40-40-20 aspirational goal for the state, my perspective is really that we start here. I mean, it really, even the prenatal kind of care that we give mothers, it's so critical in terms of lifelong success. And so, you know, you're talking about being connected with K-12, but I would hope that also the community colleges and the universities are also involved.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos?
Gallegos, right.
Thank you.
He's the one that got you the water.
Thank you. we definitely are. And I just lost the question. I apologize.
Community colleges.
Higher ed. Yes, community college. We have also representation from Chemeketa Community College on our Early Learning Council, and professor from George Fox University has been a part of our design team that's been working on for the last 2 years.
We're going to have some quick questions if it's quick. We need to move along.
Okay. I just was wondering if you could remind us again, since this is Department of Education, if the funding for this is coming out of the Department of Education budget or if it's out of DHS.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, it's the money that was previously used for the children and families, and it's coming out of the Department of Education. That's where we live.
Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michelle, thank you for your presentation. Good luck. I had a couple of things that I'm not familiar with, so you're picking up the early learning. I understand that. But you're taking on English as a second language, and I don't understand that focusing on quality to address is Common Core. We don't have time. You're welcome to provide me that later. I don't understand that. Megan, Head Start is not on there. Is that money still flowing directly to Head Start, and it will continue to flow through Head Start? Did we get the second year of the Head Start budget item resolved?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, thank you for that question. Head Start is a federal program, so we're asking Head Start providers to coordinate with their early learning hub, and with great success. In fact, the woman from Yamhill who was going to be here today if she didn't have the flu is actually the Head Start director of Yamhill County. Now, the state also has Oregon pre-kindergarten funds that go to Head Start programs, and those are still going directly to the grantees they've always gone to, with the added requirement in their contract that they coordinate and work directly with their hub toward a shared set of goals and outcomes.
Real question.
That it?
I have one more.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Megan, again, so we still have a year or so we're going to be bringing in more hubs and everything. What if a county decides they don't want to have a hub? Are they not going to receive any funding from the state of Oregon for their early learning and for their children?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett. I'm trying to think about how to answer that because
back,
I think
you can get back to me.
I will get back to you on that. What I will say is, again, we need to think about, we have moved from a county by county system to a hub, and so if a county would say they didn't want to be the hub, what we would probably do is work with other organizations to be able to serve the children of that region. Do you still want more, Representative Wisnett, or is that enough at this point?
Well, I don't think that's acceptable. I mean, we have to, the children, you know, they need the funding, we need the program. Well, the county says, I'm going to run my own program, I don't want the state involved in it.
Okay.
I will.
Okay. We're moving on. Actually, we're taking a lot more time than I thought. It's been informative, and I'm just delighted to hear all this. Is there something we can hold until a later date? Is there something, do you need to follow this up, this algorithm? Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we're fine. We expect to be back in front of you many more times
yes.
as the early learning hubs get up and running, begin to get results, begin to have challenges that they face that we need to figure out how to remove barriers for. So we appreciate the opportunity to update you on the process of just getting up
yes.
and going, and to hear from Michelle and to see how truly special what they've put together here is, starting with the people who they need to serve and the phases yes. of life, getting down to the programs that meet that need. I think this is a really special way that Yamhill has started to look at doing the work that we look forward to seeing some results from over the next year, and thank you for the opportunity.
I would like you to come back during the intro to come back and tell us more. And we're so excited about Yamhill. That's wonderful. And we know we're going to be hearing from other hubs in the future, and we'll be very delighted to do that. So thank you so much. Any last question?
For next time when you present, I'd love to hear more about the kindergarten readiness.
Great.
How you're processing that information, feeding it back into the hubs.
Yes.
Thank you.
And thank you for the material of this especially. Thank you so much. With that, we're going to close the informational hearing on the Early Learning System Hub report, and we'll open up an informational hearing on public assistance program integrity. So, colleagues, you will remember that late in 2013, toward the end of session, that we formed a work group in this committee to look at ways of strengthening the integrity of our public assistance programs in Oregon, especially the SNAP and the TANF. And Representative Gallegos was on this committee, as was Representative Wisnett, and we had several goals. We wanted to make certain that these programs are available to everybody who needs them, and people who are eligible are encouraged to apply, and these programs have an important role in getting people back on their feet. And second, we wanted to ensure that benefits are being used responsibly by clients and vendors, and improper or fraudulent use is unacceptable, and we wanted to explore cost-effective measures of increasing the integrity of the programs. And third, we discussed improving communication between DHS and law enforcement and the legislature and the public. And there was a lot of confusion and misinformation out there about these programs. And we know it's important for the public to understand their value and their purpose. And I think all the members of the work group learned a lot from these meetings. They were productive. And some of the resulting recommendations are already being put into effect. And other recommendations would require changes to federal law or action by future legislature. And we have Liesl Wendt is here. Jill, are you coming up also? And first
She's
of all,
excited. Yeah.
Representative Olson, who was the co-chair with me on this committee. Do you have anything important to say? Or unimportant?
Oh, yeah, unimportant. Okay, members. Guests. How's that?
Excellent.
All right. I don't know if you remember, last year we had 8 bills that were scheduled that had come in to this committee, and we chose not, we didn't move any of them. And as a result of it, it was really a great opportunity for us to move forward with this work committee. And I really appreciate, Liesl, you being deeply involved with this, and you look like you're doing 2 jobs right now. And Jill, appreciate you too as much as you've done. We've met several different times during the off season. Great opportunity to really learn a lot of different things. One of the things that we really try to kind of flush out deals with the bill, Representative Woods, that you are interested in about trying to hold some accountability for, well, taking dollars out of ATM and plugging them in from the trail card into something else. And if I'm just an ordinary citizen, I'm watching that go down, I'm thinking, that's got to be the SNAP program. What are they doing that money? But those are kind of things that Representative Gallegos and Representative Wisnett was there. And we kind of learned that. And as a result of it, we kind of thought, well, we need to kind of focus a little bit more on some education along that line. And there's a whole bunch of other things, too. But I'm just going to stop right there. I'll probably plug in more. But.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Liesl Wendt, and I'm currently a Multnomah County Commissioner, but on leave from DHS as the Self-Sufficiency Director. So both Representative Olson and Representative Tomei twisted my arm to wear both hats today, so I appreciate that. So what I wanted to do today was kind of give an overview of some of the challenges that we talked about in the work group, what the framework was for the discussion, and give you a sense of where some of the recommendations are. Some, as Representative Olson said, are already underway, and some are outside of Oregon's purview. They're really national issues, so try to give you a sense of that. So the two programs that we really ended up looking at are two that primarily use the Oregon Trail Card. So TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Program, and then SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And part of the conversation was really trying to identify what are the issues and who actually oversees those issues. So where does the buck stop, so to speak, on some of those? So SNAP, as an example, is 100% federal program. So while there are things that we can do about encouraging people to enroll in the program and do outreach, the rules of that program are federal rules. And so as you've heard around the Farm Bill, a lot of those discussions actually were happening simultaneously at the federal level as we were having some of these same conversations at the state level. And I should just add on to that, both Representative Tomei and Representative Olson and I met with Congressman Schrader, who was on the Farm Bill committee, so that we could express, here's some issues that we identified in Oregon, and really asked him to carry some of that water at the federal level.
So some of the objectives were really, what can we do now? What are longer-term issues that might require either funding or legislation? Wanting to balance, as Representative Tomei said, being cost-effective with how do we make sure we're not infringing access for the people who most need these programs. And I'm going to actually have Jill skip to the next slide just for a minute. We'll come back to it. One of the more major pieces of confusion that I think we anticipated is, how do people actually use the cart and what is it for? I think many people presume that the Oregon Trail cart is only for SNAP, so only for food. And in fact, TANF benefits are on the Oregon Trail cart, as are corrections benefits. So when a prisoner has income when they're leaving the prison system, their benefits are actually on the Oregon Trail cart. So when someone's purchasing something that's not food, it's likely from one of those two other sources. And I think that was a really important piece to clarify. And in addition, the cart works like a debit card. So somebody has to have a PIN number in order to actually use that card. And then when the card is lost, the benefits don't stay on the card. They then get reallocated to a new card and a new PIN for the person that's using them. And I think those were where a lot of the concern is around people's use of the card. And so it was helpful to offer that clarity. And I should, the link that's on the bottom also has an 800 number. So if somebody in the public sees somebody using a card and they're concerned or they think there might be fraudulent behavior, they can call. And that number goes to the Department of Human Services, and we have a team of folks who investigate those claims. So I think that's another really important piece that we talked about, is the department does actively do things around this program, around program integrity, and wanting to make sure the legislature knows that, the public knows that, and that law enforcement knows that. So we will go back to the former slide. You have an actual copy of the report that has all of the recommendations. These are work group recommendations specific to Department of Human Services that I wanted to highlight. One is a statewide replacement line. So last fall, the agency began there was concern about people asking for multiple replacement cards in a given period of time. So we streamlined that activity. So clients now call an 800 number, and they actually report their card, and then they're mailed a new card. And this has actually cut down on replacement cards significantly. We've looked at June of last year to June 2012 to June 2013, and it's about a 15% decrease in cards that are being replaced. And if you look at over time, it's definitely each month it's significantly smaller. So that has been a smart deterrent. The other piece is that we were sending the replacement letters to people if they'd lost 6 cards in 12 months. And actually, at the guidance of the federal government and our own observations, we've changed that to 4. So that's probably also helped with the replacement piece. One of the pieces that we're looking at is the federal government has said you must send this letter after somebody has lost 4 cards, but they have said you also can't withhold the card from clients. So we're in a bit of a funny place that we're trying to kind of research what's the best way to have that accountability piece to this equation. And again, that's a federal issue. One piece that if it's not up and running, it will be shortly, is creating a dedicated 800 number for law enforcement. Representative Olson had invited a few folks from the Salem Police Department to take part in the work group, and one of the concerns they had expressed early on is, who do we call, and is this something that the department is paying attention to? And we had our lead investigator take part in the work group, and they were able to build some relationship and some understanding between each other about what our role is as the agency and what law enforcement's role is. So they'll kind of have their new hotline and kind of move to the front of the line, so to speak. One of the big items that came up in the Secretary of State audit last spring was closing the loophole for people who have lump sum winnings, or lump sum amounts. That could be lottery winnings, that could be retirement. And we've taken advantage of a federal policy option that the state has that just went into effect in January of this year, where if somebody has $25,000 of a lump sum, they are not eligible for SNAP. Now, let's say somebody won the lottery, but they are extremely low income. They use that money to live on, and then 6 months later, it's been spent down for whatever reason. Then at that point, they would be eligible. But that's a change that just went into effect. And we don't, no one has been affected by it immediately. We don't expect it to impact people who are currently on the program. So it'll likely be for new folks or somebody who's on and has the good fortune to win the lottery. That's also an issue that was discussed in the Farm Bill. So we're kind of sifting through the Farm Bill to see what exactly the federal government did that we can then implement here. So this is not an issue that's been unique to Oregon, but I think we've taken the steps that we could, at least had at our disposal. Another item, and there was actually a bill on this from Representative Hannah, that would require employees to report fraud. So what we did after lots of conversations is go back and look at what do we actually say to employees, what's their training, and what's the follow-through around employee awareness. And, you know, to be honest, we found that it was pretty light. We talk about it, but we're not as clear about it as we need to be. So we've changed our training manuals. That's already happened after the last session. And then we've really begun having a chapter on employee awareness as part of our actual training program. So that's a piece that we didn't think we needed legislation to do that, but it certainly, the legislation prompted it to the agency to say, we need to be more clear about this. In addition, so the improved collaboration and communication with law enforcement, some of that's relationship building, some of it's the access to the 800 number. And some that we're still exploring is our team doesn't have easy access to an issue. So if they're going to go do a home visit for some reason where they suspect fraudulent behavior, they don't have any way of knowing, are there other issues going on with that family? It really becomes a safety issue for the people who are out in the field. And so we're exploring what are ways that we can have better access to that information so that our team is prepared when they're out in the field and vice versa. Let's see. You know, other pieces that we've really looked at is the collaboration is also doing training. So law enforcement has kind of point-in-time trainings, and they said if you deliver us a canned training, it can go out to all local law enforcement, and when it makes sense, they can put it in their training plans, which is great. I think that's a piece that is underway right now, kind of low-hanging fruit. Another piece that we're looking at is doing data mining, and this also hits on the collaboration with law enforcement to start to identify, are there common merchants where we're seeing issues? Is there a part of the state where we're seeing some common activity, and how do we share that information among the people that need to know that information?
Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, maybe you'll get to it, but... You know, up here we have these wonderful ideas. We put them into bills, and then they have to go through something called fiscal. And so I'm just looking at this list, and I'm wondering if that's sort of possible. And then even training. I mean, there's a cost to training,
right,
compared to then the degree of fraud or the money we're losing in terms of fraud. It'd be great if we could see those two numbers.
Absolutely. Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, it's a great question. It's sort of the return on the investment. The pieces that were up here, the warning letters, certainly there's a cost to sending additional letters. The training piece, we were actually able to kind of substitute and really revamp the training, so it had even a broader impact than just this topic. Some of the others that are either researching, you can imagine that's going to come back with a fiscal. But some of them were kind of low-hanging fruit that we could really adopt and take the initiative on. One that's not on here but is in your report is a legislative package, which would be a package for additional investigators. Currently, the state has 21 investigators, and I think in the work group that came up any number of times that that's just not sufficient for the volume of issues. So you will likely see a package that would increase that team's capabilities.
I'm going to ask folks to hold their questions until we get through, because you may be answered in some of the presentation, then we'll come back and ask questions.
Thank you. So let me actually, that question is a good transition to talk about some of the other issues that surfaced in the work group. And some of these really are legislative. One would be requiring names to be printed on the Oregon Trail cards. Right now, if we go back to that other slide, there's a number and a space for an authorized signature, but it doesn't have the person's name on it. So that would be one that Representative Olson had a bill before and is something that may be revisited. And we have fiscals worked up on that particular concept. Another one is addressing privacy concerns. So the audit from the Secretary of State suggested data sharing with PERS and lottery, and as we've investigated that, in order to share data with lottery for lots of reasons above my pay grade, we would actually need a legislative fix in order to get that information from lottery. So you'll be seeing a legislative concept in 2015 to resolve that issue. The one around increasing capacity I just mentioned, so building up our program accuracy and recovery unit. Supporting DHS efforts to develop interagency agreements that would give investigators access to other tools and databases. So that might be a shared legislative concept with law enforcement. That's still something that we're just investigating how. I don't know if that's something we do jurisdiction by jurisdiction or if we can do something on a statewide level. So that's something that we're still looking at. And then there's several other issues that really are at the federal level. One, Representative Tomei has already taken some action on, which would be the Social Security Administration current policy is that they publicly post somebody's Social Security number when someone passes away. And the audit identified that as a place where people gather Social Security numbers and then fraudulently apply for benefits. So asking Social Security Administration to address a policy change on that issue. Another one is terminating benefits when a recipient fails to respond to contact from an investigator. Right, this is an issue that Representative Olson has brought up and has looked into what other states are doing. So right now, if an investigator goes out, asks someone some questions, can I quote you on this one? The person can say, go pound sand, and there's no recourse that the investigator can take in that particular case. That was not my quote, though, so I got to attribute that to Representative Olson.
You mean the pound sand?
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't recall that.
Oh. There were witnesses.
Yes.
The other is requiring all lottery winnings to be reportable and counted. So, again, that was part of the Farm Bill, and we're diving in to see kind of how far the Farm Bill went on that and what we can do at the state level. So there was wide-ranging discussion, I would certainly say, at the work group, and I really want to thank Representative Tomei and Representative Olson for their leadership. It was a really some difficult topics and differences of opinion, but you really helped us get to what are the factual pieces that we can do, and how can we take some steps that are in front of us. And with that, that's all I have at the moment, but happy to take questions.
Thank you, Lisa. Representative Gumberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for being here today. You touched on this briefly, but I wanted to go back to it. Regarding your data mining activities, talk to me about whether this information that's collected becomes public record.
It's a good question. I don't know that I know the entire answer to it, so I'd have to get back to you. But just to give an example of, some of the mapping that the team does is if somebody lives in one county, are they going repeatedly to another county to use their card? And starting to kind of do radiuses of where are people going, and if they live in one place, are they often going to merchants in other places? But I don't, as far as I know, it's internal use, but I'm happy to follow up and get back to you.
Yeah, so you're talking about data mining in terms of the users, right? Rather than collecting data that indicates sales volumes, particularly for targeted populations by particular merchants. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. We do some around merchants. That's a great point of clarity, though. The federal government oversees merchants. So when there's an issue with merchants misusing or participating inappropriately in the program, that's something that USDA's Office of Inspector General, that falls under their jurisdiction. The state's jurisdiction falls on the client side.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for allowing that quick follow-up.
You're welcome. Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you and Representative Olson for your leadership on this. I attended one of the meetings in my office attended. Vicki Olson represented me at the other meetings. I think it's important. This committee has approved funding and bills to help provide this service to the people that need it. But when the people are abusing it are taken away because there's X number of dollars. So it really, the more we can do to stop abuse and waste in this, as Representative Wizzit's bill was trying to do, the more we have for those people who need it. I had several questions. You've answered them all, except I would suggest that you provide this committee with your analysis of the Farm Bill on what other things came out of that may address what we were working on and looking at.
Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnett, we certainly will. We're in the midst of finalizing that. And one piece I didn't mention, but I should, is I think there was also a common agreement that prevention is really the best way to go. And so if there's ways to invest in client education and awareness, simple things like when you give a client a card saying, this is like a bank card, hold on to it. This is really important. So there's some recommendations there around how do we be more proactive with clients about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable.
Representative McKinney Geyer.
Thank you. I had questions about the 85 cent swipe fee. Mm-hmm. We've been dealing with this on the student debt side. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. How does ours compare to other states? What kind of financial institution or, you know, contracts and arrangements do we have?
Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, that's a really good question and an important concern. The first few transactions, I want to say two, don't have a charge attached to it. And I don't actually know what other states do and where we fare on that, but I'm happy to follow up with you on that.
And it's 85 cents after.
But then if a banking institution has an additional fee, that would be in addition to that.
Right.
So it's a significant concern when you're looking at it.
Love to know more, because sure. On a grand scale, that could be a lot of money.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good question. Thank you. Representative,
could you refresh us as to the amount of money that the Secretary of State's audit showed was fraudulently used by the numbers of people that were essentially using them fraudulently?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I don't have the number exactly in front of me. It was half of 1%, but that was looking at three different programs. So we could break it out for you by SNAP and TANF, if that's what you're asking.
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I can just, if you remember the Secretary of State audit, one of the things that they revealed during that, they looked at the three-year period of time from 09 to 12 to 2012. And the one area that they looked at really hard was the replacement card issue. They had recorded 37,300 times of five times or more for replacement cards. There were a few times that they'd recorded up over 30. They also came to the conclusion that through that, if for every 100 cards were to be considered toward fraud, they equated that to about $20,000 worth. So if you're gonna, if you do the math on that, you're talking about $7.4 million during that time period.
Okay.
But that's what the Secretary of State came up with, and I got to hand it to you. Department of Human Services has really been proactive on that area, especially when you started doing the letters of notice at the 6, dropping that down 19%, and then now where you're at 4. I mean, they have really worked hard to control this.
Great. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate all the work you've done. We'll be hearing from you more in the future. With that, we will close the public hearing on the informational hearing on public assistance program integrity, open up the informational meeting on Oregon Housing and Community Services update. Hello, Margaret. Welcome back.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Very glad to be here with you today to provide an update on the recommendations that I've made to the governor and the legislature about redesign and transition of the programs and services in my agency. Some of this will be review. I'll be fairly quick so that we can get to any of your questions and anybody else that you need to hear from today. You'll recall that this journey started back in December of 2012 with a call from the governor to really look deeply at service delivery, community partnerships, and fiscal sustainability, and the way in which we do policy and governance. And along the way, we looked at a variety of what we called sort of challenges. What was the problem statement that we were trying to go after with a deep look at service delivery? And these are ones that I think will be familiar to members of this committee, and we've talked some about them here. A fiscally unsustainable business model, a lack of cohesive, integrated policy. I recall the first time I was in front of this committee, it was hard to get our heads around who's in charge and what are all these players and how does it all work. We identified a number of other things about kind of things that were lacking, if you will, in the way in which the agency has been historically running its complicated set of programs. And then you'll remember this was one portion of that sort of set of challenges. And the while you can't see it here, I think you'll recall that at the top of this chart is kind of the different policy bodies, advisory bodies, named in statute. In the middle part are the programs and funding sources, those colored diamonds and circles. And then the boxes at the bottom where, with all the lines drawn to them are the community partners that do the work on the ground. And for as confusing and sort of comical as this depiction is, it in some ways it belies the real challenge. So, for example, we don't even see clients on this chart, right? This is just, this doesn't even get to the client. So if it's this confusing for our community partners to access resources, imagine the client perspective. The other thing that I came to appreciate about this depiction of our challenges is it's not the existence of so many partners that is the problem. And in fact, I think the wide variety of community-based partners and actors on the ground is really an asset for us. It's that we've made it so hard for them to access programs that they need to help their clients. So as we started this journey, I actually received, my agency received this budget note in the last session that really echoed a lot of what we talked about here, echoed what the governor had called for, and it was this was sort of the charge. Go try and figure these things out in your transition analysis and redesign process. And so these are pieces that we have, I think, mostly satisfied. There's a few that I'll call out that we want to spend more time working on. For example, key performance measures. I think that's one where we need more study and we need a policy body in place. But otherwise, I think we're on a really good path to have answered these parts of the budget note. So one of the things that was pretty interesting as we were studying pretty deeply our operations and service delivery was the fact that the housing, the importance of housing was getting a lot of attention separate and apart from anything we were doing. And so, for example, I began to see, my team began to see that national foundations like the MacArthur Foundation were doing deep studies on the importance of housing to the stability of families and children. There were studies about how stable housing impacts health outcomes. We've begun to see people linking reentry to society out of incarceration. The success of that and the ability to avoid recidivism is really deeply tied to a person's ability to gain housing after they're released and so on. And so there was a lot of conversation, and some of you, I had some of these conversations with some of you, about, you know, while you're studying deeply that question of service delivery, it sure looks like housing is fundamental to a lot of other things that we say we care about in the health and human services world. And I just think that was an interesting sort of part of the landscape. So as we, inside Oregon Housing and Community Services and with our community partners, began to sort of think about what recommendations we wanted to make to the governor and the legislature, it really was quite clear that this idea that housing is foundational to these other pieces, that health outcomes, safety outcomes, and the rest of them, really without stable housing, families and individuals will struggle to attain their goals. You cannot achieve economic security if you're struggling with poverty, if your housing situation is not stable. And I think we've talked about that in this committee as well numerous times. And so with all of that as part of the landscape and the considerations, we tried to be very clear about what goals we wanted to achieve with a redesign. And it really boiled down to these two, that at the end of the day, we want to serve more Oregonians more effectively within the housing system, and that we also really want to have the housing system be a support mechanism for the other parts of the system. That the achievement of economic security for people is really, again, helped by having a strong housing system that's integrated. Members of this committee will probably recall that I was in front of you a handful of times throughout the year, and this was the process map. Once we established it, I'm proud to say that we were able to stick with it, that we had these various phases. It was a lot of work. It involved a lot of person hours, but I think it was really illuminating and was very helpful to sort of making sure we covered just not just policy aspirations, but really what's going on with the programs and how does the money work. I did convene a temporary transition advisory committee that was cross-sector that I think was particularly helpful in this regard. The other piece that I think was proved helpful to come back to again and again was this idea that we had a framework where we could be clear about our guiding principles and our values, what do we want the future state to look like if we're going to redesign the programs and services or the agency itself. And so that was an important element of the process, and we continue to come back to these themes even today. So with that sort of recap of process, I want to move into my recommendations. I have four major recommendations, which I'll highlight, and there's a lot more detail, which I think you have some of in the materials for the meeting. And again, I'm happy to come back or speak with members individually if you want more detail than what's here today. But the first major recommendation is really around refocusing the agency, streamlining our functions, and really refocusing to become a facilitator of local and regional prosperity efforts. And you'll recall that at one point, I think it was among the options was the possibility that we would disband the agency and send its programs to different parts of state government. After all of the exhaustive analysis, we really concluded, and I concluded, that that probably wouldn't save money, and it would only serve to make the policy and direction more diffuse. So we moved away from that possibility and said, let's retain an agency but refocus it. Clearly, part of that means that we have to understand and manage differently to our financial model. There's a lot of information and material that came out of our scenario building, our service delivery mapping, around how we can just really simplify the way it is we administer programs, you know, from grants administration to compliance monitoring. And so I think there's a lot of material inside of that that will help us move forward in a positive way.
Margaret, before you move on there, so will you be elaborating on some of these when you're talking about refocusing the agency? Mm-hmm. I understand simplifying the administration. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Continuously support and improve the culture.
Yes, Chair Tomei, thank you. I will. I'm racing through. I probably don't have to race quite as much as I.
No, you're fine. We've got at least a half hour.
So the continuously support and improve the culture. I think there's a piece here about how it is people who work for the agency, and it's not just my agency. I think it's every agency, how they see their role and feel a duty to be good public stewards. And sort of that's the culture of, in some ways, bureaucracies, and I use that term endearingly and respectfully.
Great, I got that then.
But it's this idea that if we want to refocus and be a facilitator more than a regulatory compliance officer, if you will, that's going to require an investment in sort of training and coaching within the agency itself. You can't just flip a switch and make that happen.
Okay,
so it's the importance of culture in really delivering these changes.
Okay, thanks.
My second big recommendation gets at really the heart of what I think this committee called out very early on, and that is to redesign policy and governance. This is to move away, not immediately, but transition away from the existing 10 statutorily named advisory bodies and instead come up with one really higher level housing policy commission that is data-driven and research-driven, that can establish priorities and outcomes, that then we can insert some accountability mechanisms for how we do our work and how we report back to the legislature. I think it would be advisable that this body, you know, take steps to advise on the agency budget and be much more involved in kind of setting policy and program direction across the whole continuum of programs that my agency runs instead of isolated bodies looking at isolated streams of funding. We had great consensus around this recommendation. Everybody could see the need for this. I will say that when we come to kind of implementing it, it means that we will sunset some existing bodies that are named in statute and groups that currently have a job. And so I think making that transition will require its own sort of diligence and sensitivity and so forth.
It's going to be very difficult, as you already know.
And I'll come back to implementation in a minute. Third big recommendation is around infusing or instilling mutual accountability. And I think if we have this higher level policy commission that I'm envisioning and that I've talked with some of you about, that we can really help that, have them help us set outcome goals that are linked to other parts of the system, and that we step up and be an accountability agent ourselves, but really then move to, as we distribute funds to community-based partners, think differently about performance-based contracting. Think differently about, and again, you don't do that overnight. You work collaboratively over time to think about moving your grant agreements and contracts to a place where we're setting outcomes that the policy body has said are the right ones. Well, what's it going to mean if you don't hit those outcomes? And nobody's in trying to punish community-based partners, but I think as a system we have to move to a place where we've got a different level, a higher level of accountability. I think this one will also be tricky, but I think people are ready for it. We do know that some other agencies in state government have taken some steps in this regard. We'll learn, you know, work collaboratively with them to think about lessons learned and how to phase this. And then the fourth big recommendation is continuing to drive alignment. It doesn't sound new and different, but what I've learned so far in my tenure in state government is that it's one thing to have leadership at agencies say, we're in this together and it's all good and let's do this, but again, to some degree, going back to that culture question, it's not second nature to employees who are running programs and are very busy with their day-to-day work to get their heads up out of their work and think, now, what are those housing people doing? Or if a program person in another agency is paying for housing for a client, for them to say, wait a minute, what am I doing paying for housing, and shouldn't we be thinking about how we do that? Isn't there a housing policy commission? Isn't there an agency that does that already? What expertise might they bring to this? This is not about me or my agency saying we have to control every housing dollar. It's that exists in state government. That's not what I'm proposing, but I do think we need to continue to drive a conversation about how do these things get integrated in real time when people are doing their work in state government. So those are four big recommendations. There's some other ones. I believe you have a two-pager front and back in front of you. If you don't have it, we'll make sure you get it. That goes a little deeper. Not tons of detail, but across all the program areas, from homelessness prevention to housing stabilization to rental housing and home ownership. So across every sort of program area in my agency, we do have a set of recommendations about how to streamline and how to focus and make things more simple. So with those broad brush strokes and a nod from the legislature, what we'll do is continue to do that next level of planning for the remainder of this fiscal year, calendar year, and prepare to build our budget for 15-17 and our legislative concepts for 15 that will implement this. And so there's a lot of work to do to sort of get that next level of detail nailed down, to continue to work with partners to think about how are we actually going to put this in place. So lots more work, but we begin to have something that feels like a North Star that we have been lacking and are feeling actually pretty good about that.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Any questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. It's fun to see how far you've come in a year. And I was kind of having this image as you were talking about
instead of having all these different hoses, like what's at the end of the spigot, instead of having all these different hoses going out and trying to water the garden and no one knows have you watered that part or not, it's almost like you're coalescing around a hose so you can see where the dry places still are, and then you're making sure that, you know, what's happening on the ground is held accountable. But I kept also thinking about how do we go to the other end, not the end of the spigot and not the hose, but how do you go to where you turn on the water more? Because one of the huge challenges is the huge need for affordable housing and how we don't have that, and it's the foundation for everything. And I was just thinking about, you know, hopefully at some opportunity you'll have the ability to think about social impact bonds or public-private partnerships or, you know, the infrastructure bank that Ted Wheeler has been thinking about. Like, what can we do to increase the water that's going through that hose? So that's kind of just, you know, I hope that once these things get settled and things are more organized that we think about increasing the pie, not being smarter with what we've got.
Right. I think Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, I couldn't agree more. And I think with confidence that we've really done what we can on our end to sort of get our act together, if you will, and to be really clear, I think that will set us up for different kinds of conversations about what are the other tools. There are other states that are doing some pretty innovative things, and I'm eager to get my own head out of the operational sort of guts, if you will, to be able to sort of think longer term. So I'm feeling pretty good about that.
And Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, one of the major questions that seems to have been constant has to do with governance and structure. And are we going to get more specific into governance and structure, say, in the next round, I guess?
Yeah, Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, absolutely. There is more that we've been talking about that I have begun to map out in that regard, but I agree with you. Governance and structure really are major drivers for how we kind of take it to the next level. I have a lot of ideas, but I think it's a conversation we need to have at that next level.
Follow up.
I'm
kind of anxious to see that, particularly with regard to then community services. Yeah. If we're going to keep it in there, how is it going to sort of, right. What's it going to look like? Right. So.
Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, just a quick note on the community services. I am recommending that almost all of our programs stay within the umbrella of the agency as it is today, and I'm sorry that I wasn't clear about this in my quick flyby. There are a couple of programs that I do think were probably better long-term managed elsewhere. One of those are the food security programs that currently reside in my agency. My recommendations are that those go to DHS. So we're working with DHS to sort of think about what would that look like and what would that require and how doable is that? We won't just flip a switch. The rest of what we do is a housing resource, whether it's homelessness prevention or helping somebody pay their heat bill or weatherizing a house or building a rental apartment community. Everything else really has a much more clear nexus to housing. And so I want us to be thinking about not two sides of the house so much anymore, but it's really a continuum. So that may be something you and I could talk further
Great.
About.
Yeah, I'd
I would like that.
Thank you.
Great. And you're still involved with this
yep.
group, right?
Yes.
And was Representative Whitsitt, was she also the person involved?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
And I was going to say CASA also.
And CASA and Oregon Volunteers are the other one that needs to go.
Okay. Yes. Good point. Great.
Yes.
Any other questions?
I've got one.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation. It's quite interesting and well done.
Thank you.
And knowing of the odd, that's the only word I've got for it, the position that you were put in and the confidence that the governor obviously put in you, saying we need some changes, but I want you to help us through this. How much, I'll put you in a tough spot, but how much executive input have you had for this presentation and also for the bills that we've got possibly lined up, the concepts we saw here for 15. Is that a close relationship, or is it just say a little more about
that. Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam, it's a close relationship. I did brief the governor before the holidays, actually, and walked him through all of this with some more backup. He was very engaged and very interested, and members of his team sat with me and continue to work with me pretty closely. So I feel like there is a very close alignment. I think there's a good enthusiasm for the potential that a high-functioning agency with these programs and services can really leverage a lot of other things that are important to the administration. So.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. Margaret, could you stay there? We have two more people who want to speak, Jennifer and Doug Riggs, and why don't you stay there in case there are other issues we need to discuss together. Welcome again. It's good to see you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships and speaking today on behalf of the Housing Alliance. Thank you for accepting public testimony. I noticed that you were taking public testimony and thinking about this year that we've just come through, and I wanted to just take the opportunity to talk to you about the things that I focus most on, which are, you know, what are the policies, what are the resources that we are kind of moving through the legislative process in spite of this reorganization conversation. And I just want to highlight a couple things. I did submit some testimony. The first document that I submitted is a list of what was accomplished in 2013 in the legislative session around housing issues. And just as a reminder, we did some really huge things. We passed a document recording fee dedicated to veterans housing. We allocated $5 million in lottery-backed bonds to preserve existing federally subsidized housing. We passed the Section 8 bill, which will go into effect July 1st, and will hopefully increase access to subsidized housing for more and more individuals and increase the locational diversity of Section 8 vouchers. And we implemented foreclosure reform, which we are starting to see really work in earnest just in this last month or so. So really exciting progress. The other things that I submitted are Housing Alliance documents, the 2014 Housing Alliance legislative agenda, and then a little one-pager of what do we still need to do in the next 10 days, because that's very much my focus. I think I've had the opportunity to speak, or Housing Alliance folks have spoken with most of you about the need to increase resources for the emergency housing account, which is allocated through Housing and Community Services, and also still more money, still more lottery-backed bonds to preserve existing affordable housing. We do, on the Senate side, we expect to see the opportunity to purchase bill on manufactured housing to move. We did, there was a compromise negotiated on that, again, on the Senate side this weekend, so we expect that to move, but there's a little bit to do still in the next 10 days. And actually, Representative Kenny Geyer, you gave me the perfect segue to the last bit of this. There's obviously a lot to do in the years ahead to create housing opportunity, to engage all parts of the market, the private sector, all of our community partners in really making a difference, driving the needle on creating housing opportunity and linking housing to these other systems. I think it's great news from the Housing Alliance point of view that Housing and Community Services will continue to exist as an agency. We look forward to continuing to engage with them, so that's one of our three pieces of good news that we see going forward. We also, the Housing Alliance, with Representative Reardon and Representative Parrish, one of the bills that didn't move forward in the 2013 session was the proposal to lift the preemption on inclusionary zoning. And as a result of that bill coming to this committee, we have created kind of a larger conversation about what are the things that we need to be doing, how can the state act as a catalyst to development on the private side, how can we look at locational issues, access to housing, mobility, et cetera, and how can we be thinking differently about resources and how we can apply state leverage and the tools that we already have. that work group met for the first time in January is sort of an organizational meeting. We have our first really substantive meeting in March, and we really look forward to reporting to you in future sessions about what we're proposing. Our goal is to come back to the 2015 session with a combination policy and funding package. We've got the home builders, John Chandler of the home builders is helping me with the legislative leadership convene that group. We've got realtors, we've got bankers, we've got community-based advocates, we've got great geographic representation, so it's a really exciting, and we've got the department at the table as well as the governor's office. So we're really excited about that opportunity and look forward to reporting on that. And then the last thing that makes me feel optimistic is the existence of this committee. I think it's made a huge difference, the work that you've put in. I want to thank you for the attention that you've paid to housing, and I really look forward to having a housing committee as we go into future sessions and doing this work. So thank you so much for all of this.
Thank you, Janet. That's good to hear.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Network. John Miller and Ruth were going to be here today but couldn't make it, so I am filling in for them. I want to echo Janet's comments about the work of the committee, and we very much appreciate having a housing focus in the House. It makes a big difference. The Oregon Opportunity Network has been deeply involved and engaged with the OHCS over the last several months in the transition.
Remind
work.
Us what that is.
Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Thank you.
Right. We have held focus groups along with the department. We've served on stakeholder committees, conducted research into best practices in other states, and been engaged on a variety of levels. We are looking for bold and significant transformation of the department, and we believe that OHCS needs to change significantly in order to improve the delivery system and serve Oregonians better.
And Doug, who is it you're representing?
Oregon Opportunity Network.
And tell us who they are.
So they are all the nonprofit deliverers of housing throughout the state, and some community development organizations as well. So organizations like Housing Works or CASA of Oregon, Salem-Keizer Development Corporation, et cetera.
Okay, so, thank you.
Yep. We believe a key important point, we've talked about this with many of you, that housing is a social determinant of health and one of the key fundamental foundational social determinants. So if we want the multiple system transformations that are currently underway in healthcare and education, et cetera, to reach their full potential, we really have to focus on housing as a result, focusing on that. So I will say just a couple things. First of all, we're supportive of the concepts that Margaret has outlined so far. Formation of a single overarching governing body or policy commission is something we agree with and strongly support. Consolidating and reorganizing programs with the goals of reducing administrative overhead and efficiency, also things we support. And consideration of models in which home ownership funds are passed through to a nonprofit collaborative is something that we talked about with the department as well. An awful lot of work, it remains to be seen in the next year, and we look forward to working with the committee. We have a few specific issues we'd like to see worked on. We'd like to see the commission have the authority to set statewide housing and community services policy with clear linkage to other state agencies that have some responsibilities in this area. We believe the commission needs some fiduciary responsibility for an entrepreneurial business model and a clear role in developing and monitoring the financial plan of the organization. I think Margaret talked a little bit about the role in the budget process. We think that's important. And we also strongly support a transparent process that would invite input from a broad set of constituents in setting up this new design.
Doug, so let me. Don't you feel like there's already that kind of collaboration? It sounds like
absolutely.
There has been. Okay.
Yeah, I think there really is. I think the devil's in the details, but I think we're making a great deal of progress.
Thank you.
Last couple of quick points. Three things we think the governing body's role ought to include are balancing local needs and differences with state policies, using an equity lens to determine how various community needs are affected. Working in partnership with regional and local providers and provider networks is also important. And then finally, aligning with other state initiatives, and I've mentioned this before, healthcare reform, education reform, employment reform, corrections, et cetera. all our issues.
I hope you would include mental health.
Mental health,
people
absolutely.
Leaving the state hospital.
Absolutely. You know, those are all very important programs. You know, we have folks in our housing developments, and the department works with clients and consumers all, who are touched by all of these various areas. So I think, again, we have been very involved in the process so far. We look forward to working with the department and with you over the next few months and coming up with a model that will really improve outcomes for the people at the foundational level of this system, and that's the clients, the consumers, the people who benefit from these types of programs. So,
great.
Thank you.
And I think one of the things we know, too, we've heard here, is that people leaving the prison system have a difficult time finding housing, and I hope that that's one of the things you'll keep in mind. Because in order for them to have jobs or continue their education or even their probation, they need to have a stable housing situation. So I hope you keep that in mind. Kenny Gard, did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, that's a specific group, mental health,
yes.
Domestic violence. We had a bill that came through before from the Recovery Association project that was based on the Oxford style, and it's like so little money up front. If we pay the down payment, that was kind of getting me on thinking on a revolving loan fund or a public-private partnership. How do we really increase the pie that way? So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Janet and maybe the director can help. I'd like to put it on the record. This committee should be concerned about this and do everything. I've talked to Representative Buckley. There's a movement, as Janet said, to put more money in the housing counseling function. The money we got from the banks, we've only spent a small amount of that. And there's a big increase in demand for counseling now as we've got the system up and operating. And so there's a request. Janet, if you can explain how, because we knew that they were getting like half of what they got before, and we were waiting to see, the director knew about this, and so now we're going back to the budget writers to say we need more money now and in the future. So you want to explain to the committee how we're doing
that? I'd be happy to, and if Margaret wants to add in. Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, thank you. That's a great question and would be great to have on the record. What we're seeing is, the foreclosure bill, Senate Bill 558, went into effect in August of 2013. Sorry, what year am I in? And we're just now starting to see a real uptick. That was the bill that that sort of fixed the quirks in the law that requires lenders to sit down with homeowners facing foreclosure prior to going into foreclosure. So the bill that went into effect in August made that effective for all foreclosures, both judicial and non-judicial. And what we're seeing is that the banks have now adjusted to the new law and the new procedures, and we're starting to see a dramatic uptick in the number of banks that are servicers that are requesting these foreclosure or mediation conferences. The data is still pretty new, and so we weren't able to come to Ways and Means and say, you know, we know that we're going to need another $1 million. We think that we're going to need probably an additional $800,000. What we did work out with the department and legislative fiscal is that the department is going to pull resources in from the second half of the biennium to fully meet all of the demand for foreclosure counseling that they're seeing, that the counseling agencies are seeing right now. Homeowners have a 35-day window to respond and accept, opt into the foreclosure resolution conference. So we don't want to see homeowners who are unable to access counseling and lose that 35-day window and lose their opportunity to take advantage of this. So we expect that we will be coming back in May to the emergency board to request additional resources to get us through the second half of the biennium. At that point, we'll have another 3 months of data showing what the demand is. We'll see there's still several large lenders, Bank of America, Citi, and Wells, I believe, are the three that have not yet even started taking advantage of the foreclosure counseling, the resolution conferences. So we may see those come in, and so we'll have a better sense of what the demand is. But for now, we've got an agreement that we're all content with. It's on the record at Ways and Means. And again, thank you, Representative Wisnett, for bringing that up. Did you want to add?
Good. Any other questions or comments? Great. We're right on time. Thank you so much. And thank you,
much.
Margaret. And we'll be hearing from you later during the interim. Thank you so much for your involvement. So with that, any last words? We are meeting on Wednesday and I think on Friday, right? We have agenda. We
don't have anything. There's no agenda posted as yet.
For Friday? Okay, but we will be meeting on Wednesday. So thank you again. We'll close the informational hearing on Oregon Housing and Community Services, and we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you all very much. 2 minutes.